This year, our Easter Sunday, which is April 21st next week, happens to coincide with the exact day in which Swami Kriyananda left his body in 2013. I mean, this is a coincidence that's not going to happen very often, but it's happened right now. This also happens to be a very interesting time in the last month, in the flow of Ananda's work worldwide. We have tremendous positive developments happening all the time in India. They're founding the Indira Institute, and we have just many, all the news from India is really good. On the West Coast, some of our colonies, including ours, are facing various challenges. Many of you know we've been in this very complicated situation with the future of our residential community. We can explain the details to you later, but its future is a little bit uncertain at the moment for reasons that are somewhat beyond our immediate control. The Seattle community also has various things it's facing, and they've had to pause their school. They're going to have to pause their school. We're facing all kinds of challenges and changes in our school, all of which we all just go forward. Everybody goes forward. Portland and Laurelwood are in the midst of huge shifts. Some of them look really optimistic. Some of them look really challenging. I could go through my own personal stories. If we wanted, like, turn the microphones over to you, I'm sure everybody can stand up here and say, you know, this is the best of times, this is the worst of times. And in my long history of Ananda now, I can't tell you how many times people would say, oh yeah, everybody's having a lot of, this is a really challenging time, starting like on June 1st, 1971, when I first arrived. It's always like, this is a really challenging time. A lot of people are going through a lot. And then the astrologers will tell us, and they will tell us. I just was sitting with someone in another city a few days ago, and you know, she just suddenly said, well, if your birthday's in July, that means this. And she started drawing this picture of how everything was angled to everything else. And I was just, you know, holding on by my fingertips, and God was gradually, undoing my fingertips. You know, which was pretty accurate. You know, it was pretty much what it felt like, because everybody's having a hard time now. Should I go on farther? Should we go national? Should we go international? You know, and I can add to it. My, I can really add to it. We're in transitions of the yugas. This is Dwapara Yuga shifting into Kali Yuga. We have a Swami in India who's told us all of these things that are happening. I'm not making fun of any of this. Pardon me? Kali into Dwapara. Whatever it is, it's all always happening. And it's always happening for a very simple reason. That's what we're doing here. No matter how many times I say that to myself, and I'm sure no matter how many times I say it to you, every time it happens again, we're surprised, aren't we? And then even worse than surprised, there's some vague sense within us that something has gone wrong, because here I am being asked to grow again. Isn't that annoying? You know, I find sometimes when I really trace it down to actually what's bothering me about whatever is being asked of me or whatever external circumstances not going the way I want it to go, is just because I know I'm going to have to rise to the occasion and meet it. You know, and I don't want to have to rise to the occasion. I want to curl up in a little ball with my teddy bear and have it be all okay. Isn't that what we're all sort of like? We're always caught between those two forces. I remember, years ago when something happened and it was suddenly revealed to me that a karmic condition that I thought was resolved was not at all resolved. It had just receded into the background, waiting for the moment when it could just jump out like a lion from a bush and start clawing me to pieces again. And I was very upset about it. I was actually driving in a car with Swami. He was driving and I was next to him, and I was just weeping my little eyes out. And I think they were, and I recognized it too clearly. It was very interesting. I'm looking at Navashan, who's no longer standing there, but he was reading it. He said, when the masters weep, they do not weep tears of self-pity. They weep tears, and they do weep for the sufferings of mankind. And so, but I just had to sit and think about that. Wow, that is a really interesting and important thought, isn't it? Weeping tears of self-pity. Master called tears liquid cowardice. I mean, this is a woman speaking to you, and she's really good at crying. She's gotten really good at it. But I had to just recognize in myself, what am I crying about? I mean, sometimes, yes, it is grief for others, and that is the truth. We have to, sometimes it really is, you know, I can't bear what's happening to my child, to my mother, to my friend, to the planet, to the refugees. I mean, it's really easy to have your heart broken in this world. And the masters had their hearts broken. They had their hearts broken many, many times because that's what this world is like. This world, unfortunately, is designed to break our hearts, break our hearts open. And it's very, very complicated. In this story of Jesus, which we're going to be working through, I mean, today, and if you come next Saturday for our retreat where we go through the oratorio singing it, and then again on Easter Sunday and on Good Friday, I encourage you to participate in as much of this as you can. This story of Christ's life is our story, and it's so dramatic, and it's so full of unexpected twists and turns, and it has so much magnificent music and so much magnificent drama. It can lift us an inch above that self-pity and allow us to see it as it's really happening. But it doesn't just resolve beautifully, effortlessly is what I mean to say. It resolves beautifully, but not effortlessly. And Palm Sunday is this paradoxical moment when Helen was reading through the Bible description of what happens here today. Many of those who had seen Jesus raise Lazarus from the tomb. Talk about dramatic. Here is, and bear in mind, this is a very small community of people. The town of Jerusalem is not that large. The whole community of Jews scattered through that whole area, they're just a small group. And if the tradition of the Essenes is true, which I believe it to be true, where Jesus was part of this very close-knit community that had places and people throughout the land there, they all knew each other. They all talked to each other. Word would pass because this is what they were interested in. Mary and Martha's brother, Lazarus, dies. And he dies. They send word to Jesus that he's sick, but Jesus doesn't go to take care of him. They all know Jesus could heal him. They all believe for certainty that if Jesus came, Lazarus would be fine. But Jesus is in another part of the country, and he does not come. I mean, they don't comment in the Bible about what that must have done to those who love Lazarus, like, why doesn't he come? But he didn't. And so Lazarus dies. And with great grief, his sisters wrap him in the winding sheets and place him in the cave, which was the tomb, and then roll the big rock over it, the same as happened for Jesus later. And then Jesus shows up. And the sister says to Jesus, if you had been here, he wouldn't have died. Now, those are just flat words on a page. They could be said in many different ways. If you had been here, he wouldn't have died. Or if you had been here, he wouldn't have died. And it doesn't say in the Bible, you know, there's no acting instructions like that. But it would not be hard to imagine that there was a little bit of annoyance in that. If you had been here, he wouldn't have died. And then Jesus answers and says, well, this was for the glory of God that it happened this way. And then he insists on going over to where the tomb is, where Lazarus is buried. And then he insists that they open the cave. And then there's that marvelous frank statement in the Bible that says he's been in there for 3 days. It's going to be really smelly. I think they actually use the word stink in the Bible. I mean, he's decomposed. A body becomes very unpleasant. But Jesus insists on rolling the rock. And then he calls Lazarus out of the tomb. And Lazarus gets up. He's still wrapped in all this stuff. And he walks out of the tomb. Now, this really happened to real people. So believe me, word went out. And so now there's also this incredible struggle between those people who are just hoping with everything they have that the promise of the scripture has really been fulfilled, that in fact the Messiah has come and the Messiah is this man. After all, he raised Lazarus from the dead. And this is by no means the only miracle that he's done. He's done miracles everywhere. And they're all saying one to the other, but the power structure of the temple is not about to believe that this is the Messiah. For whatever their karma is in this whole thing, they're not going to accept it. And most of the people have been used to looking up to those priests to tell them what's right and wrong. So now all of a sudden they're caught between the comfortable reality of the external world that they're used to and this strange but compelling inner call. Does that sound familiar to anybody here? We weren't there when Lazarus walked out of the tomb, but have we ever felt caught between the strange inner call and the comfortable situation in which we have settled ourselves and got it all organized and planted lemon trees that are not going to even bring fruit for lots of years, but we're going to stick right there and watch them do it? Just all the things that we do to plant ourselves in our way. And so all of this comes to a head, to an extraordinary head, starting with Palm Sunday. Because whereas Jesus has always held back a little bit, you know, he brings these confrontations to a head. He gets the people so elevated and so excited with the miracles that he's doing, but then he always withdraws. It says in the Bible, he goes away with his disciples. He, in some cases, he seems to almost dematerialize. He just disappears. The Pharisees, the priests are coming at him, and then he gets away. Over and over this has happened. So now it's all really, because of Lazarus especially, it's really coming to a head, and everybody goes to Jerusalem for the Passover to celebrate in what is considered to be the most holy place. So everyone wants to know, is Jesus going to come? And what's going to happen? And so now Jesus steps into it completely. And he goes into the city in a grand procession. And he not only allows, but he encourages his disciples. So it says in the Bible, they were crying out with joy and acclamation because of all the miracles they had seen. Isn't that interesting? It's an interesting phrase. I just heard it for the first time. Because of all the miracles they had seen. He has promised that he's going to do something to make this world right for them. I mean, that's why they were crying out? Because of love for him? Or because of the hope that he was going to make it come out the way they wanted it to come out? He's going to be their king. They're not going to be an oppressed people anymore. The biblical prophecies are all going to be fulfilled. And so they run after him. Now, Jesus knows that, in fact, he is what the Bible has promised he is. He knows. He's a God-realized master. He's an avatar. He knows why he's come. But he also knows the fulfillment of that prophecy looks a little different than all those people think it is. Creation itself knows, because when the priests say to him, "Rebuke thy disciples, it's not seemly that they should be praising you in this way," he says, if you silence them, the very stones will cry out. I mean, it's just such a beautiful picture. The power must be expressed, and if you don't allow the humans to do it, creation itself will do it. He's just declaring the truth of it. And so everybody, how few in that music detect the sad note of approaching disaster by human destiny road. Because it isn't our destiny to just have the Messiah walk in and we'll walk along behind him and he'll just do miracles left and right. Because that would not liberate us. And so we walk this path all the time where, on one hand, the miracles do happen. And on one hand, we're overcome with this irresistible desire to shout out Hosanna to the Lord because of all the miracles we've seen. And we march gloriously in to be crucified. And Jesus knows it. And with perfect equanimity, he weeps for the suffering of mankind, but never in self-pity, because this is how it's done. Now, I was remembering in this sitting here, you know, many of you know the history of Ananda, when this book that I've written about Swamiji that I keep talking about, and pretty soon you will see, probably by the end of May, I'll be able to hold up a copy for you on Swami's birthday. We'll declare it published, but then I'm going to hold that one copy to me because the others are coming by ship from Hong Kong, so you won't get to have it in your hands. But in that book, I naturally tell the whole history. I do tell the whole history of Ananda, and one of the very, very dramatic moments, which many of you know about, was from 1990 to 2002. It wasn't a moment, it was 12 years. And it was two different lawsuits. Persecution these days all goes through the courts. That's where it happens. Even when we were being tried, and that's in both meanings of the word, tried very intensely, we could always go out to lunch at a restaurant and come home and sleep in our own beds. And we would talk about that. This is a lot better than it has been at other times when we were put in prison or just thrown to the lions. You know, persecution takes many forms, and now it's advanced to the point of litigation. That's nice. So it's just about your time and your money. It's not about your actual survival. But we went through two different lawsuits, and one of them we won, and the second one we lost. And the one that we lost was a complete character assassination of both Ananda and Swami Kriyananda. For Swami especially, it was an absolute crucifixion. For the rest of us, we were just deemed to be brainwashed idiots, you know, trapped under the machinations of this evil leader. And a jury decided that, in fact, we were. Well, there you have it. And Swami described himself, as he put it, as standing up for the whole yoga movement, because every single prominent teacher at that time was attacked and accused of abusive action and financial, sexual, personal power, all of them. Really, there wasn't one notable ashram that wasn't more or less mowed down during that period of time. Some survived, some did not survive. Most of the teachers did not survive very long after. Some are still living. Some went to India. Some died. I mean, it was quite a time. And Swami stood up. We stood up to it. We refused to compromise. We wouldn't pay people off. We just stood up to it. And in the end, we got mowed down too. We just walked away after that. But we did. But Swami wrote afterwards, and all of that is a long introduction. He said, I wanted to stand up and vindicate the yoga movement, vindicate the reality of spiritual teachers and what yoga really is in America and what the future is, and help people to be more mature in their understanding. He said, but that didn't happen. For various reasons, we were not allowed to defend himself. He was not allowed to speak. None of the sort of way we thought it was going to play out played out at all. Instead, we're judged guilty. We didn't want to appeal. We were on the edge of bankruptcy. We couldn't appeal. We had to let the verdict stand. It was just a mess, a total mess. And afterwards, Swami writes, and this is the phrase, sometimes for a great cause to move forward, blood must be spilled. And he said, if blood had to be spilled, he said, I am grateful that God chose me to do it. Now, I mean, that is really quite a statement, isn't it? And if you think back to every important movement, whether it's in the, you know, especially in the spiritual world, but even just think of the American Revolution, you know, the War of Independence, or you think of the Civil War in America. Sometimes when a great cause moves forward, blood must be spilled, because tapasya is required, sacrifice is required, courage, determination, and the power that comes from that. You know, power does not come when people just say, oh yeah, whatever you want, I'll just go do it. Yeah, you just go ahead and you just do what you want. We hear these stories from most recently of World War II, of people who had the courage to risk their own lives. I read a story about a man, Nicky's Home, it was called, a little documentary about this British man who found himself in Prague, Czechoslovakia in 1939. He was a 29-year-old wealthy sort of playboy. And he saw what was happening there, and he personally got 700 children out of Prague. And their parents just had to put them on this train with little numbers around their necks. And they just went off to England, where he'd arranged for English couples to just take them home, not knowing whether this was a year or for the rest of their lives. And in almost all cases, it was for the rest of their lives. And for years, these children didn't even know how they got there. And then, like 30 years later, this man's wife finds all the documents and makes it a public story. I mean, one would like to think that one would have that kind of courage, but would we? Often for great causes, blood has to be spilled. And that man then has become this catalyst for this whole movement of young people to do brave and righteous things. To do brave and righteous things. Sometimes the courage to do that comes when you see someone who has so much power. Many people were converted to Christianity because of the way the Christians were sacrificed in the Colosseum. Now, any rational person would think that that was a terrible disaster. But Swami has often commented that that was the making of Christianity, because those people would rather die what looked like a horrible death than repudiate their higher truth. So we think it should all progress in this easy way. But in fact, it doesn't, because, as Swami put it, the energy has to come from somewhere. And where the energy to create new things comes from is when we, as individuals who are dedicated to it, draw that energy to a powerful focus within ourselves. And then how we use that energy, yes, we have to act as intelligently and as capably and as honorably and as lovingly as we possibly can. But the whether or not that manifests in the way that we want it, the power of success is in the doing, is in the unwavering commitment to God's will. That's all. Mother Teresa of Calcutta, who is so well known for helping all the poor people, when she was asked once about her success rate in helping the poor, her response was so magnificent. She just looked at the journalist who asked her and said, "I'm not helping the poor." And he was completely confused. She said, "I'm doing what Jesus asked me to do." You see, a world of difference there. We set ourselves, and we have assignments. God has given us assignments. You know, it's not casual, those of us who are on this path, who have given our lives to this path. Swami, representing Master, he wants education for life. He wants a new form of education. He wants communities, because that's the social pattern of the future. He wants to bring Divine Mother to people's consciousness. He wants to make God experience inward and not outward. He wants to make it a matter of self-effort through Kriya Yoga and grace through the Guru. It's not like we have to wander around and ask what we're supposed to be doing. The assignment is so gigantic. One of the reasons I wrote this 700-page book, when Karen picked up the mock version of it, she sort of held it in both hands and said, "Well, we're going to sell a lot of e-books, aren't we?" You know? But the reason it had to be so long is to lay out all those ways in which we can dedicate ourselves to God and liberate ourselves in the doing. So it's natural to think, I mean, it's only natural to think that he would make us succeed in those efforts. And he hasn't made us fail yet or ever. But even what is failure, sometimes blood has to be spilled. But if in that, no matter what comes to us, we just look to the horizon line and we see the power of God and we walk through whatever we need to walk through. This is what Jesus did. He comes in riding on the donkey and everybody's acclaiming him. He allows them to acclaim. He defends their right to acclaim him. He lets them believe that this is the coming of his kingdom, and he knows it is the coming of the kingdom of God, except it's going to look like crucifixion. And would we have it any different? You know, in my tears of self-pity, I certainly would. as Mother Teresa said, God never gives you more than you can handle, but sometimes I wish he didn't have so much confidence in me. That's one of my favorite prayers. You know, I know that this is the right size for me, but maybe you've measured me incorrectly, right? But he doesn't. And we get to do this every day. We get to do this every single day. We have Palm Sunday. We have Good Friday when we get arrested and we get silenced and we get muzzled and we get humiliated and we get tortured. Then we get crucified and then we get resurrected. Wowie zowie, we're resurrected again. Look at us, we're so much bigger. We did it, we did it, we did it. And then wham, there comes the next one. Because we're not done till we're done. And then when we're finally free ourselves, we get to do it for everybody else. This is the fourth and last stage. And somewhere in all of that is the bliss of God. Swamiji talked about when he was first expelled from Self-Realization Fellowship and at the age of 36, after 14 years in the monastery, found himself living with his parents in their spare bedroom. And I was very touched by this. Swami gives us all the right clues. He said, I lay on the bed staring at the ceiling and prayed to die. I mean, that's a fairly low point. I just prayed to die because he thought he didn't see where his life was going to go from here. Everything that he'd believed in had been taken away from him, and he just prayed to die. But God said, no such luck, basically. No such luck. You're going to stand up. You're going to keep walking until you reach the end point. Now, here's the last thing about that, when that state of mind. When he finally was coaxed out of the bedroom and began to do public work again, and he gave a lecture, a small lecture that Dr. Haridas Chaudhary arranged for him. And afterwards, people remarked that what they noticed most about what he was doing was how much joy they felt in his presence. And Swami said, in writing about this, joy? He said that is the last thing he felt for himself. But then he said when he really thought deeply about it, he realized way down deep behind everything, he said there was a stream of joy that was untouched. Now, it's not joy as we think of it, pleasure, happiness, convenience, it's all going to work out. It was a much deeper joy. It was the joy that caused them to exclaim when Jesus came into Jerusalem because of the miracles they'd seen. I mean, that's what the real joy is. Oh, look, I know what my life is about. I know where it's going. I know that the end point of this is God. And all I have to do, just like Jesus did, is just put one foot in front of the other with faith in that power. And everything ends. Swami says, one of his favorite couplets in all the songs that he wrote was in the Song of the Nightingale. Every grief, every wrong has its ending in song. That's how he puts it. Were it not for men's woes, he said, who would smile at a rose, he puts it very lightly. But isn't it all of a piece for all of us? The power that we develop from the challenge is what opens our heart to the joy. God bless you.